Richard Forer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. Noam Chomsky calls the Israel-U.S. and Palestine relationship a fateful triangle. He says, in no other region of the world are the problems so likely to lead to devastating regional conflict. He adds, those problems have only been aggravated by the irrationality and intolerance that has dominated discussion in the United States. It will be unfortunate, Chomsky warns, if this state of affairs persists. Chomsky wrote those words more than 50 years ago. The U.S. has given Israel hundreds of billions of dollars in aid over the years. In addition, Washington provides crucial diplomatic, political, and military support. Internationally, because of Gaza, both the U.S. and Israel are increasingly isolated. Moshe Yalon, former Israeli chief of staff and defense minister, says Israel is committing war crimes and ethnic cleansing. Our guest today is Richard Forer. He's spent time in the West Bank and Gaza. He has Orthodox Jewish relatives living in West Bank settlements. He's a former member of AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. He's the author of Wake Up, Essays on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, winner of the New York Big Book Award. I talked with Richard Forer at the Boulder Public Library in late March. I want to welcome Richard Forer to the program. Good to see you again, Richard. Anti-Semitism.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country. Never. But these are not idle threats. President Trump is trying to break us so that America can own us. That will never, ever happen.
The Liberal Party in Canada had been massively trailing in the polls. Then it pulled off a victory that seemed impossible just 2 months ago, largely thanks to one man, President Donald Trump, who repeatedly threatened to make Canada the 51st state. We'll go to Newfoundland to speak with the Canadian journalist Paris Marks. Then today is the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. We'll speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning Vietnamese-American writer Viet Thanh Nguyen about Vietnam, Trump's first 100 days, and more.
I see the Vietnam War as just being an episode in a long history of American intervention overseas. Philippines, Korea, Japan, China, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and Iraq and Afghanistan, and the rest of what's happening in the Middle East are really extensions of that of these policies.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian health officials say Israeli attacks have killed at least 39 people across the Gaza Strip over the past 24 hours. That includes three massive strikes on residential buildings in the Nuseirat refugee camp that survivors describe as feeling like an earthquake. Overnight, Israel continued attacks on tents and other shelters for displaced Palestinian civilians in Khan Yunis and al-Mawasi. Survivors say bodies of their loved ones were left unrecognizable by the airstrikes in an area Israel had designated as a so-called safe zone.
Do you see the rockets that fell on us and on the children at home? They were sleeping. We were sleeping deeply, only to get us out of the house like that. And we started running with the children at midnight. It is unfair and fair world.
Israel's released a jailed Gaza paramedic who survived a deadly attack on medical workers last month. Assad al-Nasrallah was among at least 10 Palestinians released from an Israeli prison into Gaza Tuesday, all of them in poor physical and psychological health after they reported being tortured. Al-Nasrallah was imprisoned without charge, held incommunicado for 37 days after he survived the March 23rd assault in which 15 of his fellow aid workers were killed by Israeli troops and buried in an unmarked mass grave, some of them bound and with gunshot wounds to the head and chest. Their ambulances and a fire truck were also buried nearby. President Trump signed executive orders Tuesday, rolling back his previously imposed tariffs of 25% on cars, trucks, and automotive parts. Trump's reversal came as U.S. consumer confidence fell to its lowest level since the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt responded to reports that Amazon was planning to display the cost of tariff-related price increases alongside all Amazon products.
This is a hostile and political act by Amazon. Why did Amazon do this when the Biden administration hiked inflation to the highest level in 40 years?
Amazon later said it had no plans to show the cost of tariffs on its products. Several news outlets reported the apparent reversal came after Trump personally called Amazon founder Jeff Bezos Tuesday to complain. On Capitol Hill, House Republican leaders used procedural rules Tuesday to prevent Democrats from forcing votes on measures requesting information about Elon Musk's potential conflicts of interest. The impact of DOGE's cuts on states and local communities, the Trump administration's use of the consumer messaging app Signal, and more. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson dismissed the Democrats' resolutions of inquiry as, quote, political stunts and, quote, nonsensical waste of our time, unquote. On Monday, Michigan Democratic Congressmember Shri Tanadar filed an impeachment resolution against the president, citing Trump's, quote, sweeping abuse of power, flagrant violations of the Constitution, and acts of tyranny that undermine American democracy and threaten the rule of law, unquote. The impeachment resolution will be dead on arrival in the Republican-controlled House. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmembers Pramila Jayapal and Debbie Dingell joined Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders Tuesday in reintroducing the Medicare for All Act, which would provide universal single-payer health care based on patient needs, not industry profits.
Legislation would provide comprehensive care to all Americans, rich, poor, young, or old, with zero out-of-pocket expense. It would provide full freedom of choice regarding health care providers. You go to the doctor, the nurse that you want to. No more insurance premiums, no more deductibles, no more co-payments, no more filling out endless forms.
The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health has agreed to rehire staffers on programs benefiting firefighters after the Health and Human Services Department canceled the World Trade Center Health Program, the National Firefighter Registry for Cancer, and more. That's according to the International Association of Firefighters, whose president won the concessions after weekend talks with Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. However, the relief might be temporary, as many of the NIOSH programs still have termination dates scheduled for June. In more public health news, Mexico's reported a surge in measles cases in the border state of Chihuahua following an outbreak of the highly contagious vaccine-preventable disease in unvaccinated communities in Texas. Dr. Paul Offit, a Philadelphia pediatrician specializing in infectious diseases, says RFK Jr.'s anti-vaccine misinformation is to blame.
Press conferences about autism. He's held press conferences about food dyes. What he should do is hold a press conference every other day about this measles epidemic and what we're doing about it and encourage vaccination, especially in areas where there's low vaccination rates. The opposite is happening. He doesn't say that. He gets in front of the public and says measles vaccine kills people every year.
In Oklahoma City, nearly two dozen federal agents raided the wrong home and forced a mother and her three daughters, who are U.S. citizens, out of their house in their underwear in the rain, seizing their phones, laptops, and even their life savings. The agents supposedly were with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the FBI and U.S. Marshals, and had a search warrant with the names of people who did not live in the house or have any connections to the family. The women had just moved to the Oklahoma home from Maryland with her family about 2 weeks before. She spoke to KFOR Oklahoma City after the raid.
What if I would have been armed? What if you're breaking in? What am I supposed to think? My initial thought is we're being robbed. My daughter's being female, daughter's being kidnapped.
Nothing but likely lifelong trauma.
We have guns pointed at our faces. Can you just reprogram yourself and see us as humans?
It is unclear agents from which department raided the home. This comes as Trump's Justice Department directed ICE to carry out raids and home searches without a warrant, invoking the centuries-old Alien Enemies Act of 1798, which has been used to target Venezuelan immigrants wrongfully accused of being in the Tren de Aragua gang. In related news, rights groups are raising alarm over reports ICE is targeting unaccompanied immigrant children in raid operations nationwide, seeking to criminally prosecute and deport them. One critic of the policy described it as backdoor family separation. A New Jersey federal judge has ruled against the Trump administration's attempts to dismiss a federal lawsuit brought by Yale Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil, arguing the U.S. government's illegally detaining him for his political views. The court rejected Trump's attempts to shut down the case before even granting Khalil a hearing. Judge Michael Fabiars previously found his court could retain jurisdiction over Khalil's federal case, which could potentially impact other similar cases as Trump's State Department seeks to deport other international students and recent graduates over their support of Palestinian rights. In related news, a federal appeals court has temporarily paused the transfer of Tufts University international graduate student Ramesa Ozturk from an ICE detention center in Louisiana to Vermont. Arguments on that case are scheduled for next week. Columbia University student Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi has spoken out from a Vermont prison where he's been detained since his arrest earlier this month. In an interview with Vermont Public Radio, Mahdawi quoted Dr. Martin Luther King's admonition that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
And the injustice that I am facing here and the injustice that the anti-war movement is facing is also connected to the injustice that the Palestinian people are going through. We're talking about 55,000 people who have been killed. We see children being killed, amputated, losing their parents, no homes. This is what's moving us.
A hearing in Mahdawi's case is scheduled for today, where a judge could decide whether to release him from Northwest State Correctional Facility in St. Albanstown, Vermont. Mahdawi is a green card holder from Palestine who was born and raised in a refugee camp in the West Bank. He was arrested in Vermont when he appeared for what he was told would be a naturalization test. He came to the U.S. over a decade ago and began attending Columbia University in 2021, where he became a key organizer in peaceful pro-Palestine campus protests. He headed the Columbia Buddhist Association. President Trump has fired some of former President Biden's nominees to the board that oversees the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Among those fired is Doug Emhoff, the husband of former Vice President Kamala Harris, who was appointed to a 5-year term on the board in January. In a statement, Emhoff wrote, quote, "Holocaust remembrance and education should never be politicized. To turn one of the worst atrocities in history into a wedge issue is dangerous," unquote. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth declared Tuesday he was proud to have dismantled a program that boosts the participation of women in military teams. Writing on Elon Musk's social media site X, Hegseth blasted the Pentagon's Women, Peace and Security Initiative as, quote, "a United Nations program pushed by feminists and left-wing activists. Politicians fawn over it. Troops hate it," Hegseth wrote. He said it was a Biden-era program. In fact, the program was created by a bill President Trump signed into law in 2017 that was celebrated by Trump's daughter and former advisor, Ivanka Trump. It was also supported by, at the time, Kristi Noem and now Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Renowned Colombian journalist Jeanette Bedoya, who was abducted, sexually assaulted, and tortured by paramilitaries in 2000 while she was on assignment reporting on Colombia's U.S.-backed war, has dropped her case after a quarter of a century fighting for justice. Bedoya wrote on social media, quote, "The impunity in my case will go down in Colombia's history. My work as a journalist will continue," she said. Democracy Now! Spoke to Bedoya in The Hague in 2015.
To be, go publicly and say that you've been a victim of sexual violence changes your life forever, because we live in a very machista world in which they tell you that you're guilty for your rape. But I realized that if I didn't speak, other women wouldn't be able to either. And I feel like having spoken out has changed the life for many women in Colombia.
International press freedom and human rights groups had for years pressured the Colombian government to fully investigate Bedoya's case and prosecute those involved. In 2021, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruled the Colombian government was responsible for Bedoya's kidnapping, rape, and torture. And a senior Pakistani official says there's credible intelligence that India intends to launch a military strike on Pakistan within the next 24 hours. The warning came 1 week after gunmen massacred 26 tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir in a rampage that India blamed on Pakistan. Tensions between the two nuclear-armed countries are now at their highest point since 2019, when India carried out airstrikes inside Pakistan for the first time since 1971. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we go to Canada to look at how Donald Trump's threats helped the Liberal Party make a stunning comeback. We'll also look at Elon Musk's first 100 days. Stay with us.
As a new river flow in the night, somewhere, honey, some old hog stomping on the bone. Like a free stream of flame. My heart jumps straight to you. And you seem like the kind of linger there.
New River Blues by the legendary folk singer Michael Hurley, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. He died earlier this month at the age of 83. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Canada, where the Liberal parties pulled off a victory that seemed impossible just 2 months ago, largely thanks to one man, President Donald Trump, who's repeatedly threatened to make Canada the 51st straight state. Prime Minister Mark Carney and his Liberal Party won 169 seats out of 343 seats in Parliament, narrowly failing to win a majority of seats. Carney, who's a former central banker, has served as Prime Minister only in March after Justin Trudeau resigned. When Trudeau first announced his plan to resign, the Conservatives had a significant lead in the polls. It looked like Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre was set to become Canada's next prime minister. But on Monday, he suffered a major defeat. He even lost his own seat in the parliament. The campaign shifted once President Trump began threatening Canada's sovereignty and imposed new tariffs on Canada. As Trump escalated his threats, the Liberal Party soared in popularity. This is Prime Minister Mark Carney speaking at a victory rally Monday night.
America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country. Never. But these are not idle threats. President Trump is trying to break us so that America can own us. That will never, ever happen. Our old relationship with the United States, a relationship based on steadily increasing integration, is over. The system of open global trade, anchored by the United States, a system that Canada has relied on since the Second World War, a system that, while not perfect, has helped deliver prosperity for a country for decades, is over. These are tragedies, but it's also our new reality. We are over the shock of the American betrayal, but we should never forget the lessons.
But you're going to take us forward.
We have to look out for ourselves.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney speaking at his victory event. President Trump called Carney on Tuesday to congratulate him. Meanwhile, White House Deputy Press Secretary Anna Kelly said the election does not affect President Trump's plan to make Canada America's cherished 51st state, unquote. On Monday night, the Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre pledged to work with the Liberal Party.
Conservatives will work with the Prime Minister and all parties with the common goal of defending Canada's interests and getting a new trade deal that puts these tariffs behind us while protecting our sovereignty and the Canadian people.
While the Liberal Party in Canada pulled off what's been described as a stunning comeback, support for the left-leaning New Democratic Party, or NDP, collapsed. The party lost official party status. The party's leader, Jagmeet Singh, lost his own seat. To talk more about the Canadian elections and U.S.-Canada relations, we'll then talk with him about Elon Musk. We're going to St. John's, Newfoundland, where we're joined by the journalist Paris Marks. He hosts the podcast Tech Won't Save Us and writes the Disconnect newsletter, where his latest article is headlined Canada's Tech Executives Aren't Scared of Mark Carney. Paris, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you start off on the surprising Canadian victory, not surprising from this election, but from a month before. The harder President Trump went after Canada, the more the Liberal Party rose in the polls until ultimately the Prime Minister was elected.
Yeah, it's great to join you this morning. It was really a stunning turnaround over the past few months. If you'd asked people, you know, around Christmas, if the Liberal Party had any chance of forming government in the next election, they would have said, absolutely not. It's not happening. But now we see Mark Carney is poised to form a minority government, but it's a strong minority government. You know, he's only three seats away from a majority, so that won't be very difficult to govern with. Whereas the Conservative Party has still increased, actually, their vote share and their number of seats. But the leader, as you said in your opening, you know, lost his seat, and, you know, it's still unclear what exactly he is going to do to try to gain representation, or if the party is going to try to get rid of him. And I think one of the biggest stories of the election is, as you said, you know, the real decimation of the smaller parties, whether it's the New Democratic Party on the center left, which has been reduced to just seven seats, which is below the line for official party status in Canada, which means that it won't get many resources, will have limited questions, things like that in parliament, but also the Bloc Québécois, which saw its number of seats drop by 10, and the Green Party, which saw its number of seats drop from 2 to 1. And a lot of that vote went to the Liberal Party because people felt, seeing what was happening with Donald Trump and the threats that he was making against Canada, that this was not a time to allow the Conservative Party, and especially a Conservative Party leader that was using some of that Trumpian language, to, you know, be the one who kind of represents us in these negotiations with the United States. And, you know, in this moment where it looks like Canada is going to have a difficult task of, you know, rethinking kind of the status quo that the economy was built on for the past several decades.
And Paris, could you talk more about the impact that the Trump tariffs and the Trump threats to make Canada a 51st state have had on the Canadian population?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been huge, right? People in Canada feel really betrayed and really angry about what is happening because, you know, the United States is the country and Americans are the people who we arguably have the closest relationship to in the world, right? You know, we consume so much of the same culture. We have, there's so many kind of relatives and friends that live on both sides of the border. And so this real kind of shift from the American administration to really be targeting Canada has really affected a lot of Canadians and how a lot of Canadians feel about the United States as well. And that, you know, as you said in your opening, that is part of what contributed to this election victory. Of course, Justin Trudeau, the old prime minister, stepped aside as Liberal leader just a couple weeks before Donald Trump was inaugurated in January. And that opened the way for a new leader to come in to really, you know, be a representation of this anger and of the public mood. And Mark Carney sees that very effectively and kind of allowed Canadians to rally around the Liberal Party again to represent the kind of nationalism that people are feeling in this moment in response to, you know, the trade war that has been begun by Donald Trump and seems to be targeted very specifically on Canada more than many other countries in the world, of course, Mexico as well. And, you know, so that has been very significant. And there's a lot of Canadians now who say that, we might have a difficult time ahead in dealing with the United States, but we're ready to accept some economic pain, you know, in order to push back and kind of defend our interests.
Now, you've posted on social media that most of Canada's top tech executives turned against the Liberals and were betting that the Conservatives would win, but that they don't have much to fear now under a Carney as the nation's new leader.
Yeah, exactly. So around this time last year, the Liberal Party under Justin Trudeau put out its annual budget. And in that budget was a proposal to increase the amount of taxes that people have to pay on capital gains. Now, that would only affect 0.13% of Canadians, these increases that were proposed. But as you can imagine, people in the tech industry are disproportionately likely to earn income through capital gains. And they got very angry as a result of that. So, you know, kind of a worsening relationship between, you know, large tech executives in Canada and the Liberal Party came out into the open at that moment. And there was a real embrace of the Conservative Party. Over the past year, we have seen, you know, a number of Canadian tech executives embrace more right-wing policy positions. The industry has come together to create an organization called Build Canada to advocate for some of those positions. And even since Trump came to office, we saw some of those people, you know, making explicit arguments that Canada should have its own doge, you know, with all the consequences that, of course, we've seen in the United States as a result of that agency and Elon Musk's leadership of it. And so, you know, now you would imagine that with the Liberals returning to power that, you know, there would probably be a pretty bad relationship between those tech executives and the Liberal Party. But actually, Mark Carney, one of his first actions as prime minister was to remove that increase in the capital gains tax. And he's been talking a lot about investing in artificial intelligence, investing in the tech industry, rolling out AI in the public sector to increase efficiency. So even though we have a Liberal Party coming to power over a Conservative Party, that doesn't mean there aren't things to still be worried about as we see the way that they might potentially govern in the years ahead.
And talk about how unusual Mark Carney is, not a politician, but a central banker, and what that means.
Yeah, it's very significant, right? And I think we're still at the moment where Canadians are really discovering who Mark Carney actually is. You know, he does not have a political career. He previously worked at Goldman Sachs before serving as the head of the Bank of Canada during the financial crisis in 2008. And then he served as head of the Bank of England in, you know, during the Brexit crisis. And through that period, he was the first Canadian to head as to serve as head of the Bank of England. Beyond that, he has worked at a company called Brookfield Asset Management. And there has been some controversy around that with, you know, the kind of tax maneuvers and tax dealings that it has had that kind of played out during the election, but that people don't seem to have really, you know, focused too much on when it came to thinking about their vote. I would say the big thing about Mark Carney right now is he is still very new to Canadians, right? He was only prime minister for, I believe, 9 days before calling the election. And so a lot of people were kind of able to put their hopes into Mark Carney. you know, regardless of where he actually stands. And now we're in this moment where he is actually going to prove that he can follow through on the promises that he made. And so now he enters a much more difficult period than he had over the past, you know, 5 or 6 weeks, you know, as he began as prime minister and then ran this, you know, very short election campaign, because as you'll know, our elections in Canada are a lot quicker than the ones that happen in the United States.
Paris Marks, I also want to ask you about Elon Musk, who you have reported on extensively. As President Trump marked his 100th day in office, the New York Times front page headline, "There have never been 100 days like this." I want to ask you about the role of Elon Musk, the world's richest man in Washington, over these 100 days. A new Senate report finds Musk and his businesses could avoid over $2 billion in potential legal liability thanks to cuts Musk enacted as head of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. When Trump was inaugurated, Musk was facing up to 65 actions from 11 federal agencies targeting SpaceX, Tesla, Neuralink, and XAI. Senate Democrats now say Musk has largely averted those actions thanks to DOGE helping him, quote, evade oversight, derail investigations, and make litigation disappear whenever he so chooses on his terms and at his command. Paris Marks, tell us more.
Yeah, it has been a really stunning 100 days. And even the period before that, right? Before Trump came to power, was reelected, you could see that Elon Musk was already making the shift to the right globally, you know, by supporting other extreme right-wing parties. And then, of course, to get publicly behind Donald Trump, to give hundreds of millions of dollars to support his campaign. But I think even then, it was hard to imagine that he would really play this outsized role in, you know, the actual governance of the country, right? Heading up this agency that seemed to have such broad power to start, you know, going into these various different departments and agencies of the U.S. government, remaking it, laying people off, you know, forcing decisions on it. And what we have seen as part of that is, you know, this ability for Elon Musk to use this kind of profile that he has as, you know, this tech leader, this tech genius, regardless of whether that's true or not, to come in and kind of help legitimize this right-wing program that we had seen in the making for quite some time, right? Through Project 2025 and, you know, the larger kind of Heritage Foundation and these other right-wing groups and their ambitions. But then beyond that, you know, as you were saying there, one of the key pieces of this was not just to, you know, lay a lot of people off, to kill certain departments or significantly reduce the capacities of others, but also to ensure that what comes out on the other side of this is much more beneficial to Elon Musk specifically and some parts of the tech industry more broadly, with the rollout of Starlink in many different agencies, the gutting of regulators who were looking into Elon Musk's businesses. And we see that, you know, a section of the tech industry wants to really see a remaking of not just the aerospace industry, but military procurement as well. And I think that we're starting to see changes in that space, too. So it has been a really significant 100 days. Obviously, there's talk now about whether Elon Musk is going to continue. He's talked about reducing the amount of time he spends there to 2 days a week. But even then, 2 days a week is quite a lot of time to cause a lot of havoc.
And this issue of Musk's DOGE is not just centered in the United States per se. You've reported, for instance, that several Canadian tech executives recently launched the initiative Build Canada. The website lists that's its goals, building more pipelines, firing over 100,000 federal workers in Canada, and increasing immigration restrictions. What do you see the possibility of this approach of dismantling the liberal democratic state going global?
Yeah, so I think it is a serious worry, right? We often see things that happen, say, in the United States, eventually get exported to other parts of the world. And I would not be surprised if there's not a push from the political right in other countries to try to do something similar with a DOGE organization, kind of wrapping it in this, you know, kind of cloak of efficiency and you know, the use of technology and things like that, but actually allowing this further gutting of the state based on what we've seen over the past number of decades. decades already, right? And so in Canada, we have seen tech executives explicitly say that they want to see a DOGE. It's interesting, actually, the head of Build Canada in the past few weeks came out and said, no, our goal is not to build a DOGE, recognizing how, you know, that term and that notion had been so toxified based on what was happening in the United States. But that didn't also stop, you know, a number of prominent conservatives at a recent conservative conference in Canada to actually talk about how it would be easier to roll out a DOGE in Canada. And there was even an executive from Amazon there, a senior public policy person, who was explaining how Amazon and other cloud services could be used to collect a lot of data on government that would aid in this process of deciding which you know, parts of the government, which programs should be eliminated, which I think is, you know, a very worrying relationship to see, not just with these Canadian tech executives, but people from, you know, a major company like Amazon being part of these conversations in Canada probably shows that, you know, still how close this relationship between parts of the tech industry and, you know, the right wing are, especially when it comes to these efforts.
Paris Marks, I want to thank you for being with us, host of the podcast Tech Won't Save Us. We'll link to your latest article and your newsletter, Disconnect, Canada's Tech Executives Aren't Scared of Mark Carney. And we'll link to your four-part podcast, Elon Musk Unmasked. Next up, today is the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. We'll speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning Vietnamese-American writer Viet Thanh Nguyen about Vietnam, Trump's first 100 days, and more. Stay with us.
Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters, black waters rise over
folk musicians Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. They joined us in March to talk about their recent appearance at the Kennedy Center, where they unfurled banners to protest President Trump's takeover of the famed cultural institution. They played at the Kennedy Center the night that the vice president, Vice President Vance, was booed there. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today marks 50 years since the Vietnam War ended. On April 30th, 1975, North Vietnamese tanks smashed through the gates of the presidential palace in the South Vietnamese capital of Saigon. Communist soldiers hoisted their flag atop the building. Video of U.S. personnel being airlifted out of Saigon was broadcast around the world. Some 3 million Vietnamese people were killed in the U.S. war, along with about 58,000 U.S. soldiers. Hundreds of thousands of Lao, Hmong, and Cambodians were also killed. The impact of the war is still being felt in Vietnam and the region. Earlier today, events were held in Ho Chi Minh City, the former Saigon, to mark this 50th anniversary of Vietnam's victory over the United States. This is Tho Lam, the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam.
After 50 years of national reunification and nearly 40 years of reform, Vietnam has overcome a multitude of difficulties and challenges to achieve immense triumphs of historic significance, building for ourselves the fortune, the power, the international standing and prestige that we enjoy today. From a poor, backward country ravaged by war under embargo and isolation, today Vietnam has become a developing country, upper middle income that is deeply integrated into international politics, the global economy, and the civilization of humankind.
We're joined now in Pasadena, California, by Viet Thanh Nguyen, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of several books, including most recently, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other. His co-edited collection is also just out, titled The Cleaving, Vietnamese Writers in the Diaspora. Viet Thanh Nguyen was born in Vietnam in 1971, fled the country with his family in 1975. In an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, he writes, quote, "Most American presidents have learned the wrong lessons from the American War in Vietnam, as it is called there." Viet Thanh Nguyen, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's so good to have you with us. I'm wondering if you can talk about what those wrong lessons are, especially in light of the Trump administration angering Vietnam veterans, those in Vietnam as well, banning senior American diplomats from attending events on this 50th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam, and then, because of outcry, reversing themselves. But tell us what you think the lessons are and the lessons that we in the United States learn wrong.
Thanks for having me, Amy. I think the lessons or the mistakes that American presidents have made started with Woodrow Wilson in 1919, refusing to listen to the appeal of a very young Ho Chi Minh in Paris who had come to ask for American recognition of the Vietnamese quest for independence. And from that mistake, we've had a series of mistakes over the past century, mostly revolving around the fact that the United States did not recognize Vietnamese self-determination. The United States meddled in Vietnamese affairs, sided with the French in terms of their colonization, took over the French efforts after the French were defeated by Ho Chi Minh in 1954. If the United States had not interfered, I think the outcome in the long term would have been pretty much exactly the same, with Vietnam turning into a capitalist economy, which it pretty much is now, and the United States relying on Vietnam as an ally against China. The difference would have been that if the United States had not intervened, at least 3 million Vietnamese people wouldn't have died, and hundreds of thousands of Lao, Hmong, and Cambodians, as you pointed out. Now, the tradition of American presidents towards Vietnam has also included a use of soft power. We've relied on our cultural arm and our aid programs and the rhetoric of American democracy to try to pull Vietnam closer to us and to justify our intervention into Vietnam. Trump is not a quiet American like his predecessors. He's an ugly American. He doesn't believe in soft power. He believes purely in the exercise of American hard power, and we're seeing some of those consequences in many areas, but certainly in Vietnam, where he's trying to engage in a trade war or raise tariffs to a very high level, but also, as you've just mentioned, refusing to participate, at least until yesterday, in something as basic as a commemoration of a difficult and shared history.
And Viet Thanh Nguyen, yet the United States, is, not too long after the war ended, began fixing its relationships with Vietnam, and up until recently has engaged in major trade with Vietnam. Unlike, for instance, U.S. policy toward Cuba, which it never fought a war with, but it continues to isolate to embargo.
I think there's a big strategic difference between Vietnam and Cuba. Vietnam still matters a great deal in terms of the politics of the region of Southeast Asia, especially with China right to the north. Vietnam and China have always had an extremely difficult relationship ever since China colonized Vietnam for 1,000 years. Vietnam considers China its major rival, influence, threat, and so on, which means that it's willing to let bygones be bygones with the United States and wants to engage in a relationship with the United States, whereby it could use American military and political aid to be a counterweight against China. And the United States also recognizes Vietnam's potential in that way. I don't think Cuba has the same strategic advantage as it does, as Vietnam does for the United States. And Cuba has the problem of a very large, very vocal, very conservative Cuban-American population that has tremendous influence on American politics. Vietnamese Americans are also deeply anti-communist for the most part, but they don't have the same political ability to manipulate or influence American foreign policy.
Yeah, and you've written, quote, American interventions haunt the United States. President Reagan saw Central America as the next front of the Cold War after the war in Vietnam. Could you talk about the impact of the American loss in the war in Vietnam toward foreign policy in the years after that?
Well, the war in Vietnam was obviously extremely divisive internally for the United States, and it was also a war that was a complete defeat for the United States. So a complete shock in so many ways for a United States that in the 1950s and 1960s saw itself as the ascendant global power. So the setback in terms of American military power, political power, prestige, self-confidence after 1975 was quite tremendous. American presidents on both the Democratic and Republican sides set out immediately to try to rehabilitate American power. And the fears that had led to U.S. involvement in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos were still there. So in 1983, Ronald Reagan gave a speech about Central America in which he declared that this was the new front of the Cold War. Nicaragua had been lost, supposedly, to the Sandinistas. And now this posed a threat to El Salvador. And he names El Salvador specifically as the first country where this Cold War would again be waged. This set the stage for our own current political climate today, because the war in Central America, especially in El Salvador, that the United States supported, was brutal. Thousands of Salvadorans were killed at the hands of a Salvadoran military that had been trained by the United States. Numerous atrocities were committed. Many people fled northwards to the United States as refugees. Some of them became gangsters. Some of them were deported, beginning in the Clinton administration, back to El Salvador, where they fomented or helped to become a part of a very serious gang problem with tremendous amounts of violence. This created the opportunity for President Nayib Bukele in 2022 to declare a state of exception that allowed him to put 80,000 people into his prisons without due process, alleged gang members, many of whom were actually not gang members. I was in San Salvador in February on the very same day that Marco Rubio was in town to sign the agreement with President Bukele to use El Salvadoran prisons to hold deportees or rendition people from the United States in prisons that were built there directly as a consequence of this long chain of history that went from Vietnam to El Salvador and now to a deportation prison.
You have said, Viet Thanh Nguyen, that El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. If you can explain that and also go on to talk about the U.S., especially right now, though you can give us some history, which is so important in all of your work, the U.S. attitude toward immigrants. You write in your Time magazine piece that it is now, with the Trump administration weaponizing the fear of the other and promoting a moral panic about strangers coming to our shores, when these people, including those who are also Americans, become seen as a threat to the nation, they are no longer a part of us. Instead, they become the other to our collective self as a country. Take it from there, Viet.
Sure. First of all, with Vietnam, El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. That was actually a slogan of the Western left during the 1980s. The same Western left that had organized against the American war in Vietnam saw enormous similarities with what was happening in El Salvador. So that became a global rallying cry in opposition to this renewed campaign of American power in another poor country in which the civilians would bear the brunt of American foreign policy. Now, when it comes to the other, I'm quite familiar with that position, because you have to remember that in 1975, the majority of Americans did not want to accept refugees from Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, despite the very intimate and difficult relationship that the United States had with the region of Southeast Asia. Fast forward 50 years, I would say that the majority of Americans, if they thought about Southeast Asian Americans in the United States, probably generally have pretty positive images of people like us because of our food and our ethnic enclaves and the like. And meanwhile, there are now new people to be afraid of. And this is an old cycle in American history. It is one in which people in the Trump administration have participated in, from Donald Trump to Stephen Miller, who are first and second generation descendants of immigrants from Europe, who have turned in a very hard way against immigration. Vietnamese people, some of them who came as refugees and were accepted, have now said we were the good refugees back in 1975. But this time, and this is referring to the first Trump administration, these new people coming from south of the border or people who are Muslims, these are the bad refugees. So the temptation to always create new others and to forget that the others that we had been afraid of were actually not that bad once we got familiar with them, that's, again, an old impulse in American society. It's led to these periodic resurgences of anti-immigrant fear and xenophobia that we can trace very far back in American history. In this case, at least as far back as the phobia against Chinese immigrants in the 19th century that resulted in the Chinese Exclusion Act and eventually the creation of INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, which is the predecessor to ICE today.
I'd like to shift a little bit to talk about your book, To Save and Destroy, Writing as Another. The book is based on a series of talks you delivered, the Norton Lectures at Harvard, which addressed the question, what does the outsider mean to literary writing? Could you begin by giving us a summary of your answer to that question?
The book touches on it's based on the question of otherness. And I think otherness is a universal condition. I'm sure we all have at one time or another felt ourselves to be odd or alienated or not fitting in some way. But the difference for certain people is that otherness is constantly imposed on us. That's, for example, conditions of racialization or queerness. These are identities that we don't necessarily choose, although we eventually might, but they are imposed as blanket conditions. And so that dynamic has been evident throughout American literature and culture. I think most of our major artists and writers probably have felt other in some way, sometimes just simply as idiosyncratic or eccentric or weird in some ways that turned them into artists. But we have a significant tradition of writers of color, queer writers, feminist writers, and so on, who have come out of these conditions where they have been marked as part of an entire population. And that condition of otherness is obviously very troubling in a lot of ways, very sometimes disabling, but the friction produced between being an other and looking at the center of power in American culture, looking at the ways by which there are some people and some populations that rest very comfortably in their notions of their own selves, that distance between self and otherness has been enormously productive in producing some of the most powerful and memorable forms of American culture, whether we're speaking of music from black people or whether we're speaking of the literatures of so many populations, from Jewish Americans and now to Asian Americans as well.
If you could also talk about the joy of otherness, as you put it, in the last chapter of your book on the joy of otherness, you write about your experience being a father and conclude by telling the story of your sister, to whom your book is dedicated.
I think there's such a range of emotions when it comes to otherness, certainly at its most extreme version, when otherness is used to justify exploitation, domination, and murder. The experiences of otherness can be deeply traumatic and terrifying. Also, again, generative of cultural and psychological responses that are embedded throughout American culture. And other times, otherness can be more moderate and can be embedded in very, very intimate relationships within our own family, for example. I've said in the book that sometimes the other is the one who is closest to us. And perhaps many of us have had that relationship where it's our mother or our father or our siblings who are the ones that are most estranged from us or most confusing or puzzling to us. Now, that can be extremely discomforting, obviously, but sometimes that otherness is also something more gentle. The fact that, for example, I have children who are 5 and 12 years of age, they're sometimes other to me. Sometimes I look at them and I think, who are these strange people that I've participated in giving birth to and raising? I love them, but they're also quite different from me as well. And that kind of otherness, there is joy to be found in that, because I honestly did not want to become a father for various reasons, partly because I was afraid of having these new strange others in my life. But those others of my own children have taught me enormous things, most importantly for the purposes of this book, the importance of playfulness. That looking at children who don't know any rules, who do whatever they want, can be frustrating in a lot of ways for parents. But from an artistic perspective, that spirit of playfulness, of childlikeness, is something that we absolutely need to internalize and learn again and again as rule-bound adults. Now, when it comes to my sister, I had a sister. And in 1975, when we fled from Vietnam, we left her behind. And at 4 years of age, I certainly knew I had a sister. But by the time I was 10 or 11, I forgot that I had a sister. And when this letter showed up from Vietnam with a picture of this beautiful young woman, I asked my parents, who is that person? And they said, that's your sister. And that took me by surprise, gave me a shock. And so I grew up from that point onwards aware that there was an other in our family, an absent presence, who I would not see again for another 20 years or so, and who I would not see after that for 20 further years until she came to the United States last year. She timed her visit perfectly. She showed up literally the day before the premiere of my TV series, and I had the opportunity to take her to a Hollywood party where we were the first ones to arrive, and the next person to arrive was one of the stars of the show, Robert Downey Jr., who took photos with us. And I told my sister, this happens all the time for people who come to Hollywood. So after all of the tragedy of our family history, there was joy, I think, in that moment of having my sister arrive for a little bit of the American experience.
In October 2023, you were among more than 750 writers who signed an open letter calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, after which the 92nd Street Y here, 92NY, a major cultural institution in New York City, canceled your speaking engagement there. This led to major turmoil at 92NY, with many staffers resigning in protest. In your book, you address Israel's war on Gaza in the third chapter titled On Palestine and Asia. And you talk about how you see the opposition to Israel's war on Gaza as comparable to the global protests against the Vietnam War. Can you talk more about that? We interviewed you right at the time you were being canceled here.
That certainly wasn't something that I asked for or wanted. I signed that letter out of an impulse of conscience and conviction. Upon hearing one of the Israeli ministers describe Palestinians as human animals, I knew immediately what that rhetoric was referring to. It's a colonizing and genocidal rhetoric in which an entire population of people are separated from humanity and therefore exposed to the worst that we could do in terms of our so-called civilization. That dynamic has already been well illustrated in books like Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And so what I think we collectively as a world has witnessed in the case of Israel's occupation of Gaza and of Palestine and what the Israeli military has done since October 7th with the support of the United States is to use that rhetoric of civilization and to use this idea that the West is an overwhelmingly powerful force to inflict tremendous and, I would argue, genocidal violence on a population of people and to kill a vast number of civilians for the most part. So I think it is a situation that for many people outside of Palestine and outside of Israel that we can clearly see that there's a vast disjuncture between the professions of the rhetorical professions of Israel and the United States and what we're actually witnessing from Palestinians themselves. And one way in which this war is comparable to the Vietnam War is that for the world, the Vietnam War became the first television war or the first living room war. People could turn on their TVs at night and literally see images of Vietnamese people being burned by napalm, for example. And this was utterly shocking at that time. And I think there's a similar or parallel degree of shock here when we can see Palestinians using their phones to beam out the images of what it's like to be subjected to mass bombing, random bombing, to see people being blown to bits, including children. It is a shock to the conscience, and it has mobilized a significant degree of global sentiment against Israel and the United States that I don't think we've seen since the 1960s and early 1970s. And the consequences in the United States and elsewhere has been a radical degree of disagreement between those who support Israel and those who are opposed against it, and the mobilization of enormous amounts of political pressure against the people who have been opposed. And this, again, recalls the deep divisions internally within the United States and other countries during the Vietnam War. But I think one difference that's important is that now, under the Trump administration, there's been a weaponization of anti-Semitism, which is a real problem, but a weaponization of anti-Semitism to be directed against anybody who supports Palestine. But even now, under the Trump administration, the weaponization of anti-Semitism in Palestine against anybody that the Trump administration disagrees with.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, in terms of Israel, you noted in a recent interview that some research you had done more recently, you discovered that after Jimmy Carter cut off aid to the Salvadoran military government in the late 1970s because of his human rights abuses, that Israel stepped in and supplied the weapons to that Salvadoran military. As much as 83% of El Salvador's weapons were coming from Israel as a favor to the U.S. government.
Yes, that was a shock to me. I have to admit to my own ignorance in this matter that Israel was a key player in Central America, not just El Salvador, but Central America in general in the 1970s and 1980s. I think what had happened is that Israel had built up its military arms industry, obviously, as a consequence of occupying Palestine. Israel became very good at certain things like making weapons and engaging in counterinsurgency strategies against Palestinians and Arabs. And so Israel started to export its weapons. It needed to sustain its own arms industry, and it found Central America, but other places as well, like South Africa, to be good markets for its battle-tested weapons, weapons tested against Palestinians. Israel was also exporting advisors. It was exporting strategies. So, for example, the Guatemalan military turned to Israeli advisors in order to help devise their counterinsurgency strategy against their indigenous populations, which resulted in enormous numbers of deaths, including what has been called a genocide in the early 1980s. So, in some ways, Israel has long been a junior partner to the United States when it comes to military and foreign policy. Places and moments where the United States might not want to be involved very explicitly, Israel has stepped in to supply the weapons and the advisors and the technology and the strategies that the United States might not have wanted to do for themselves.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning author, professor at the University of Southern California, his latest book, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other. Also co-editor of the new book, The Cleaving, Vietnamese Writers in the Diaspora. We'll link to your op-ed in the Los Angeles Times today. Americans are still learning the wrong lessons from Vietnam. Viet Thanh Nguyen is on a national book tour. He'll be here in New York, in Brooklyn, Thursday night at the Center for Fiction, and at Rizzoli Bookstore in Manhattan on Friday. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has job openings. Go to democracynow.org to learn more. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
One World Radio Program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Come on, the peace train. Is peace train only rolling?
Everyone jump on the peace train.
Yes, it's the peace train. Come on, the peace train. Oh, peace train.
Ooh. 89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa. 88.7 WRHU Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, and 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh, Radio Carnegie Tech. You're listening to the One World Radio Show. I'm your host, Cody Millar. Joining with me is Ricky in New York and Lydia in Cape Town.
Hello, Cody.
Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon, Lydia.
Good morning to everyone, and good off. Yeah.
We are finally having the seasons shift a bit, right? I mean, it went from like 30 or 28 degrees for me to 40 the other day. And I got to say, I did not like it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just too, I don't know. For me, like, anytime it gets above, like, 70, 75 degrees, it just, at least where I am, it's so humid that I prefer a dry heat. So that's just my personal take.
Oh, really? Lydia doesn't know anything about the heat where she lives.
Not at this moment. Not at this point. We are heading into winter, so on my side,
no.
It's really cold.
Well, we're very honored and privileged that we have a gentleman all the way who... the weather in Germany might be where he's coming from might be a little bit different than it is by us. We have Professor Klaus Bernke, who is coming us from Germany to discuss the topic of cross-cultural psychology. Thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
So I was discussing this topic last night before we did the taping with my father, and he said, what is cross-cultural psychology? So for those who don't know, what is cross-cultural psychology?
Well, this is, of course, always disputed. It started actually with the feeling in the academic sphere of psychology. Psychology is the science of American college students and white rats. Some famous psychologists said that about, I presume, something like 100 years ago. And that time, it was actually the textbooks worldwide were filled with lab experiments among male American college students and little white rats who were running through mazes and things like that. And in the... Well, typically in the late 1960s, the question emerged that, well, maybe what we know about psychological phenomena is different if we have participants in our study from other cultures than what is now 50 years later called the weird countries. Weird countries means Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic country. So that nicely is then spelled weird. But this started in the late 1960s, in the early 1970s. And then psychology kind of spread out into other parts of the world. And typically the studies that had been conducted in the US were then, say, replicated, or people tried to replicate them in other parts of the world. And other parts of the world then typically in the beginning meant East Asia, and for example, the Academic Association of Cross-Cultural Psychology was founded in 1972 in Hong Kong, which was a British colony, crown colony at that time, but of course, strong East Asian influence at the International Association for Cross-Cultural Psychology. And people just wanted to know which parts of psychological knowledge depend on something that is universal, that you will find everywhere in the world, wherever you do the study, and which other parts of psychological knowledge are only understandable in the immediate cultural context where the people who you do the study with come from. But then there are also disputes of why cross-cultural psychology. Cross-cultural psychology at the same time means you have a comparative approach. So you would always want to compare culture X, culture Y, and culture Z